ओम श्री चैतन्य मनोभीष्टां स्थापितं जेन भूतले सायं रूपकदमयं ददति साहं
Are the lights dim or is it my imagination? Maybe it's my imagination. What do you think? Better, man?
There's a few bulbs down.
Ah, that's all.
Is there a, what's it called?
Yeah, these might be down a little bit.
Yeah, okay, never mind. This is the beginning of the 14th chapter we've just heard, and the 13th chapter of the dynasty of the sun. Emanating from the sun god of Maharaj Ikshaku after Surja, the Surja dynasty. And we've heard a very unique little story of Maharaj Nimi, who wanted to perform a sacrifice, and he asked Vishishta Muni to be his priest. Vishishta said yes, but just wait, I have to go to Indradev and perform a sacrifice for him. Maharaj Nimi thought, life is short, how can I wait? Who knows what's going to happen? Vishishta Muni became angry, cursed him to die. And the king thought, what is this? He's cursing me to die. Why curse him to die? So they both died. Vishishta Muni took his birth again. But when the priests who were performing the sacrifice thought that the king had been unnecessarily, inappropriately cursed, they beseeched the demigods to bring him back to life. But Maharaj Nimi, amazingly enough, refused, because he did not want to participate in material life within a material body. So much trouble, so much anxiety. This is the Vedic culture. Teaches, far different from materialistic culture, that having a body, a material body, is not going to bring us the enjoyment that we hope for. In material life, in the way that the contemporary society preaches, indoctrinates, is that we can enjoy. Look! He's enjoying. All you need is sufficient money, sufficient this, sufficient that. You really enjoy it. But the Vedic system teaches, no, it's impossible. Try as you may, you cannot enjoy, because material life is meant for suffering. Very cynical about material life. Very cynical about the possibilities of enjoyment in the material world. For one who has taken his birth, death is certain. Krishna tells Arjuna. So how can one enjoy on the material level knowing that his death is certain? So when confronted with this terrifying, terrible thought that death is certain, what do people usually do? Try to forget it as quickly as possible. Take shelter of forgetfulness, which is another way of saying ignorance, which is another way of saying illusion. So people take shelter of forgetfulness, ignorance, illusion in so many different forms, filling the spaces between their birth and their death with different forms of illusion. Now in chapter 14, we're going to hear an example of this, a very interesting story. I believe it's from the Mahabharata, the story of King Pururava. Now King Pururava, right in the beginning of this ninth canto, was mentioned. Let's see what chapter. In the first chapter, as the son of Buddha, who was the son of the moon, and we're going to hear this story. But it's very, very peculiar, his birth. There was one king named Sudyumna. This is right in the very first chapter of the ninth canto. He wandered with his friends into an area of Lord Shiva. This king wandered into the area of Lord Shiva, but that area had a curse upon it, because Lord Shiva was to be the only male allowed in that area. So anyone who wandered in that area became a woman. So King Sudyumna happened to be wandering in that area, he became a woman. But he was the king. And the citizens would not so easily accept, nor would he accept, that the woman is a ruler. So Vasishtha Muni, who was also his priest, head priest, performed the sacrifice to please Lord Shiva. And by the result of Lord Shiva's blessings, Sudyumna became a woman every other month and a male every other month. So this would be ideal for some of the people, and this is just according to their desires nowadays. But one thing happened while he was wandering as a woman. It was very beautiful. He came to an ashram of the sun, and we'll hear about the birth of this Buddha, very intelligent son of the moon god. And he became attracted to her, and they fell in love, and a child was born. And the child born of Buddha and Ila, who was the female version of Sudyumna, was named Pururava. And he was a powerful, very beautiful personage, a great king. So we're going to hear about him. But a very unusual set of circumstances surrounding his birth. So this is the first verse of the 14th chapter. Sukadev Goswami said to Maharaj Prickett, "O king, thus far you have heard the description of the dynasty of the sun god." So all the kings, and we heard them one after another, the succession of kings. One after another, a succession that lasted thousands and thousands and thousands of years. All coming from the sun god. And we heard about the end of that dynasty from the kings of Mathila. Now hear the most glorious and purifying description of the dynasty of the moon god. This description mentions kings like Oila. Pururava, he had a name, one of his names was Ayla. Now, of whom, Pururava, Ayla, it is glorious to hear about them. Now listen to this story that happens to him. Lord Vishnu, Gobadaksha Vishnu, is also known as Sahasra Shirsha Purusha, which means the person with 1,000 heads. He is the one, the Gobadaksha Vishnu, that the universe. He is the soul of the universe, the super soul of the universe. And he is the one that the Vedic, Rig Vedic mantra or hymns, the Purusha Shukta, which are mentioned in the third canto of the Bhagavatam, second canto of the Bhagavatam rather, it is mentioned, and he mentions that this thousand-headed Purusha, who is all-pervading within the universe, actually has a form of only 8 inches. I think it's the measurement from here, the thumb to this finger, the tip of the ring finger, not maybe perhaps 8 inches, depending upon the size of your hand. So he's actually the super soul in everyone's heart. And although he is pervading and all-powerful, still he has a form. So this is the subject matter of the early chapters of the second canto. But here it describes, from the lake of his navel sprang a lotus on which Lord Brahma was generated. Atri, the son of Lord Brahma, was as qualified as his father. So this is mentioned in the history of Atri. Is mentioned in the third canto and the fourth canto. His birth in the third, and his wife, who he married, one of the, I think he married Akuti, one of the daughters of Swayambhuva Manu. From Atri's tears of jubilation was born a son named Soma, the moon, who was full of soothing rays. Lord Brahma appointed him the director of the Brahmins, the drugs, healing herbs, and the luminaries. So in Prabhupada's purport, he describes what appears to be a discrepancy about the birth of the moon. But he reconciles it and explains that in different millenniums, the moon god is born in different ways. So after conquering the three worlds, the upper, middle, and lower planetary systems, Soma, the moon god, performed the great sacrifice known as the Rajasuya sacrifice, the Rajasuya Jagya. Because he was very much puffed up, because he was the conquering monarch. So when one thinks to oneself, when one is extremely successful, there is a tendency for pride to enter his heart, to enter one's heart. So the moon god, who is a demigod, who is a soul, a conditioned soul, a jiva, as we are conditioned souls, he became proud. But he was empowered. His source of his power, the source of anyone's ability, is ultimately only Krishna. So actually, there's nothing to become proud of. What is actually, if we were conscious of the situation, we would become humble and we would praise Krishna, God. But instead, there is such a tendency in the conditioned soul, due to the influence of Maya, to become proud. So he was the king, practically, of the universe. And because he was very much puffed up, proud, he forcibly kidnapped Brihaspati's wife. Brihaspati is the priest of the demigods, whose name was Tara. Although requested again and again by Brihaspati, the spiritual master of the demigods, Soma did not return Tara. He was attracted to her. This was due to his false pride. A proud person doesn't think he has to listen to anyone. He makes his own laws, his own rules, and he follows it. Another word for pride is arrogance. So he became arrogant. Soma became arrogant due to his success. Consequently, a fight ensued between the demigods and the demons. Because of the enmity between Brihaspati and Sukra, Sukracharya was, as we heard in the eighth canto, was the priest of the demons, and Brihaspati was the priest of the demigods. So Brihaspati wanted his wife back. Soma refused. Brihaspati had the demigods on his side, and although the demigods, Soma was also a demigod, he took shelter of Sukracharya, the priest of the demons, to fight with the demigods, and the demons also joined that side. And Lord Shiva, because of affection for the son of his spiritual master, joined the side of Brihaspati and was accompanied by all the ghosts and hobgoblins. So Brihaspati was the son of Angira Muni. And Lord Shiva had achieved some knowledge from Angira Muni, so therefore he took the sides of the demigods in this great fight. King Indra, accompanied by all kinds of demigods, joined the side of Brihaspati. Thus there was a great fight, destroying both demons and demigods, only for the sake of Tara, Brihaspati's wife. So this was the cause of the problem. When Lord Brahma was fully informed by Angira about the entire incident, he severely chastised the moon god Soma. Thus Lord Brahma delivered Tara to her husband. So he gave her back because Lord Brahma, Brahma means the greatest. So he is the greatest personage in a universe. So when he told Soma, "You have done something wrong. This is terrible. Look how much difficulty has caused, the demons, the demigods, so many lives, so much bloodshed due to your whimsical, proud, arrogant desire. You've kidnapped, you've done something inappropriate, improper, you should give her back." So he delivered the Tara to her husband, Brihaspati, who could then understand that she was pregnant. So these things are going on. This is quite a drama, isn't it? Brihaspati said, he chastised his wife, "You foolish woman. Your womb, which was meant for me to impregnate, has been impregnated by someone other than me. Immediately deliver your child. Immediately deliver it. Be assured that after the child is delivered, I shall not burn you to ashes." What does he mean by that? With my anger for having done this. He was very, very powerful. "I know that although you are unchaste, you wanted a son. Therefore, I shall not punish you." So Sukadeva Goswami, who was narrating this very interesting pastime to whom? Maharaj Prickett, he continued. So by Brihaspati's order, Tara, who was very much ashamed, because she had acted unchastely, immediately gave birth to the child, who was very beautiful, with a golden bodily hue. Both Brihaspati and the moon god Soma desired the beautiful child. So when Brihaspati saw this beautiful, very powerful, potent child, he wanted that child. And Soma, who was the father of the child, also wanted the child. So still this problem, the controversy, the war wasn't over. So fighting again broke out between Brihaspati and the moon god, both of whom claimed, "This is my child, not yours. This is my wife. The child is born of my wife, Brihaspati. So therefore, I am the husband of the wife. Her property is my property. Therefore, my child." And Soma said, "No, my child." So all the saints and demigods present asked Tara whose child the newborn baby actually was. But because she was ashamed, she could not immediately answer. The child then became very angry. The child itself, he entered the foray, became angry and demanded that his mother immediately tell the truth. "You unchaste woman," the child said, "what is the use of your unnecessary shame? Why do you not admit your fault? Immediately tell me about your faulty behavior. Who is my father?" Lord Brahma then brought Tara to a secluded place, because the last thing that Tara wanted to do was to speak about this topic in the midst of all the saints and the demigods and the sages and her husband. How could she possibly admit her fault in public in that way? So Lord Brahma brought Tara to a secluded place, and after calming her down, pacifying her, he asked to whom the child actually belonged, and she replied very slowly, with shame, "This is the son of Soma, the moon god." Then the moon god immediately took charge of the child. "O Maharaj Prickett," Sukadev Goswami said, when Lord Brahma saw that the child was deeply intelligent, he gave the child the name Buddha, which means intelligent. The moon god, the ruler of the stars, enjoyed great jubilation because of this son. Thereafter, from Buddha, through the womb of Ila, a son born was born named Pururava. Now, Ila, again, was the female form of Sudyumna, the king, who had been cursed to become a woman, and then by the blessings of Lord Shiva, he was a woman half the time, 1 month, and a man half the time. But during his female phase, she came in contact with Buddha, and this child Pururava was born, who was very, very, very beautiful. So this is described in the first canto, the first chapter of the ninth canto. When his beauty, Pururava's beauty, personal qualities, magnanimity, behavior, wealth, and power were described by Narada in the court of Lord Indra, the celestial woman Urvasi was attracted to him. Pierced by the arrow of Cupid, she thus approached him. So this happens to be one of the wildest stories in the Bhagavatam. Having been cursed by Mitra and Varuna, who she agitated once, this celestial woman Urvasi had acquired the habits of a human being. Therefore, upon seeing Pururava, the best of males, so qualified, so beautiful, powerful, whose beauty resembled that of Cupid, she controlled herself and then approached him. When King Pururava saw Urvasi, who was one of the heavenly beautiful ladies, his eyes became jubilant in the ecstasy of joy, and hairs on his body stood on end. So this is a different kind of ecstasy than we usually hear about. Usually we hear about Lord Chaitanya's ecstasy out of his love for Krishna, where he's exhibiting sattvika bhavas, astika sattvika bhavas, which are when the soul becomes ecstatic in its love for Krishna. Pulaka sharira, the hairs on the body stand on end in ecstasy. But this is a different type of ecstasy. When he saw this beautiful woman, he became ecstatic. And what is the difference between material ecstasy or material happiness and spiritual happiness? Spiritual happiness is based on love, actual love. Actual love means desiring to please Krishna, God. And this type of happiness, experience of happiness, is lust. Kamendriya priti, the satisfaction of one's own senses. And one selfish, petty, insignificant self is the center of the desires. So he felt happiness. His hair stood on end, but his desire was lustful. So with mild, pleasing words, he spoke to her. Pururava spoke to Urvasi as follows. O most beautiful woman, you are welcome. Please sit here and tell me what I can do for you. So this is the dealings between man and woman. The question is, what can I do for you? But what is sitting in the heart is what desire? What can you do for me? So in material dealings, lustful material dealings, the center is hypocrisy. Superficially it is what I can do for you, and actually it's what can you do for me. You may enjoy with me as long as you desire, he said. Let us pass our life happily in a sexual relationship. Satvati samaratina satvati sama. Urvasi, who was very beautiful, replied, O most handsome man, who is the woman whose mind and sight would not be attracted by you? So she had placed herself before him to attract him because she had been attracted after hearing the words of Narada Muni. So she went before him, she attracted him and expressed her attraction for him. If a woman takes shelter of your chest, powerful chest, she cannot refuse to enjoy with you in a sexual relationship. But she said, because she had fallen down from the heavenly kingdom due to the curse. Heavenly doesn't mean heaven, as in the spiritual world, the realm of God. It means a higher material planet where life is very subtle and the enjoyment is very, very deep. Most people, when they are tired of enjoyment in this world, in the material world, they take to religion, religiosity, religiousness, with the purpose of enjoying with themselves at the center on a subtle level. So that is that kind of heaven. So she fell down from that heaven due to the curse of Mitra and Varuna, two demigods. But she said, "My dear King Puruva, please give protection to these two lambs who have fallen down with me from the heavenly planets." So this is quite an intriguing story already. "Please give protection to these lambs. Although I belong to the heavenly planets and you belong to Earth," so these usually, because we see someone beautiful on this earth and it is appealing to earth-like persons because of the grossness, similarities in grossness. But usually those on the subtle, more subtle heavenly planets are not attracted to the beings of earth due to the grossness, because their existence is more subtle. "But although you belong to earth and I belong to heaven," she said, "I shall certainly enjoy sexual union with you. I have no objection to accepting you as my husband, for you are superior in every respect." So Prabhupada's purport describes how this is actually a proper way to deal, in the sense of that regardless of one's family or circumstance or externals of one's circumstance, if someone is qualified, they should be accepted as qualified, regardless of the family. And Chanakya Pandit says that that even if gold is found in a filthy place, one should take it. Who would not take it? You may clean it off, but who would not take gold from a filthy place? So similarly, if a person, a man or a woman, is found to be from a not a good family, but if they themselves are qualified, like gold has great value, one should accept them regardless of the family as worthwhile. So she said, "I will accept you, but you must take care of my two lambs." Urvashi said, "My dear hero," another restriction, "only preparations made in ghee," clarified butter, "will be my eatables." I don't eat boiled and raw things. "And I shall not want to see you naked at any time except at the time of sexual intercourse." The great-minded King Puruva accepted these proposals. So three conditions: take care of the lambs, cannot see naked, and the only eating things of ghee. Puruva replied, "Oh, beautiful one, your beauty is wonderful and your gestures are also wonderful." So he's completely enamored. Whatever she would have suggested or made conditions, he would have agreed to. "Indeed, you're attractive to all human society. Therefore, since you have come of your own accord from the heavenly planets, who on earth would not agree to serve a demigoddess such as you?" Sukadeva Goswami continued, "The best of human beings, Puruva, began freely enjoying the company of Urvasi, who engaged in sexual activities with him in many celestial places, such as Chitrarata and Nandanakanana, where the demigods enjoy." So due to her presence, like if one is with a very, very wealthy, big, powerful person, and he's used to going to this wonderful place and that wonderful place. If you're with him, you can go. So similarly, Prabhupada was allowed entrance into these heavenly places, which are only the places of demigods. Well, obviously his body was as fragrant as the saffron of a lotus. The pollen, the stamens of a lotus have a particular fragrance, and saffron is made from that. And her bodily fragrance emanated that. Being enlivened by the fragrance of her face and body, Purva enjoyed her company for many days with great jubilation. But she was actually from the kingdom of heaven, the kingdom of Indra. And Indra noticed that she was not present in his assembly, because this was her actual appropriate place in the assembly of Indra. And she was a very famous beauty in that assembly. So Indra noticed that she was not there because she was on earth with Puruva due to the curse. And he said, "Without Urvashi, my assembly is no longer beautiful." And considering this, he requested the Gandharvas to bring her back to his heavenly kingdom. So the plot shall thicken. Thus the Gandharvas came to earth, and at midnight, when everything was dark, they appeared in the house of Puruva and stole the two lambs entrusted to the king by his wife Urvashi. So they made a plot. How is that going to bring Urvashi back? Please listen. Urvashi treated the two lambs like her own sons. Therefore, when they were being taken by the Gandharvas and began crying, Urvashi heard them, and she rebuked and chastised her husband. "Now I'm being killed," she said. Because when a woman, she's thinking her children, when she loses her children, she experiences that like her own death. So painful. "Now I am being killed." Of course, they weren't exactly her children, but it was these two lambs who she thought of as her own children. "I'm being killed, even though I'm under the protection of my husband. So therefore, he is unworthy. He is a coward and a eunuch." Not a male, he's a eunuch. "Although he thinks himself a great hero." Right under his protection, he's right here. "I'm being killed. These lambs have taken away from him. You had to protect them. In your presence, they're being taken away." So what, when a woman does this to the psychology of a male, because a man naturally thinks himself the protector, immediately he pulled out his sword. She chastised him, criticized him, manipulated him actually. She continued, "Because I depended on him, the plunderers have deprived me of my two sons, the lambs, and therefore I am now lost. My husband lies down at night in fear." Exactly like a woman, although he appears to be a man during the day. So she really struck at his heart. Puruva, stricken by the sharp words of Urvashi, like an elephant struck by its driver's pointed rod. Who knows what the driver of an elephant is called in India? Does anyone know what they're called?
Mahout.
Yes. How do you know? So many things you know. It's the Mahout. He has a pointed rod called a goad, shaped like this. Krishna actually has that elephant rod, the shape of an elephant rod, on his lotus feet. Did you know that? Yes. So what happens when the Mahout, who's riding on top, and when he sticks the elephant gets up and he moves, starts to move. So He became very angry, Puruva. Not even dressing himself properly, he took his sword in his hand and went out naked into the night to follow the Gandharvas who had stolen the lambs. And after giving up the two lambs, the Gandharvas shone brightly like lightning, thus illuminating the house of Puruva. And Urvashi then saw her husband returning with the lambs in hand, but he was naked. He had promised never to be seen naked by her, and therefore she left. The plot had been successful. They used the lambs to catch Puruva in an awkward position, and then they began glowing, and then she saw him, and she left immediately. Quite the story, isn't it? Quite the pastimes. So no longer seeing Urvashi. So what is Purava, the great hero, going to do now? He was most aggrieved, and because of his great attraction for her, he was very much disturbed. Thus lamenting, he began traveling about the earth like a madman. Once during the travels all over the earth, Purava saw Urvashi, accompanied by five companions, on the bank of the Saraswati in Kurukshetra. She was gone, and then he saw her. He was wandering like a madman. It's such an amazing story, because we hear in the Bhagavatam of spiritually minded people wandering. Kings renouncing the world and wandering. Rishabdev did it. Bharat gave up everything. Who else gave up everything to wander as a madman? I don't know. There were so many, actually. Not quite like a madman. In the 11th canto, there's one very wealthy person who does this from the place of Avanti. So he wandered like a madman. Quite different from a spiritually minded madman who had detachment from his body. He was mad due to his attachment to his wife. Just see. But then he found her on the bank of the Saraswati at Kurukshetra. And with jubilation in his face, he spoke to her in sweet words as follows. Oh, my dear wife, oh, most cruel one, kindly stay, kindly stay. I know that I have never made you happy until now, but you should not give me up for that reason. This is not proper for you. Even if you have decided to give up my company, let us nonetheless talk for some time. Oh goddess, now that you have refused me, my beautiful body will fall down here. And because it is unsuitable for your pleasure, it will be eaten by foxes and vultures. Urvashi was in a different mood. She replied, my dear king, you are a man, a hero. Don't be impatient and give up your life. Be sober and don't allow the senses to overcome you like foxes. They are the ones eating up your body, your senses. And your mind is under the control of your senses. Don't let the foxes of your senses eat you, destroy you. You want to enjoy, that's your problem. In other words, you shouldn't be controlled by your senses. Rather, you should know that the heart of a woman is like that of a fox. And actually, she had goaded him in a manipulative way. There is no use of making friendship with women. Prabhupada's purport, again, as we have seen on this topic many times, is politically quite incorrect. But he insists, he's insisting here, that the nature of a materialistic woman, because he's going to put it in the perspective of spiritual also. The nature of a materialistic woman is very cunning to get their ends met. Prabhupada's purport. Chanakya Pandit has advised, Vishvaso naiva kartavyam strishu rajakuleshu cha. Never place your faith in a woman or a politician. What to speak of a woman who's a politician? Nowadays, people have learned half this. They never have any faith in politicians. But women they trust. Unless elevated to spiritual consciousness, everyone is conditioned and fallen. What to speak of women who are less intelligent than men? Women have been compared to sudras and vaishyas, striyo vaishyas tatha sudra, by Krishna in the Bhagavad Gita. On the spiritual platform, however, when one is elevated to the platform of Krishna consciousness, whether one is a man, woman, sudra, or whatever, everyone is equal. Otherwise, Urvashi, who was a woman herself and who knew the nature of women, said that a woman's heart is like that of a sly fox. If a man cannot control his senses, he becomes a victim of such sly foxes. But if one can control the senses, there is no chance of his being victimized by sly fox-like women. Even in some of I wouldn't say the highest cultures in the United States, they call women foxes. That's the nickname for women.
Vixen.
Huh?
Vixen.
Vixen. Is that the same as foxen?
It's a female.
Really? Wow, you know so much. If a man cannot control his senses, he becomes a victim of such sly foxes, vixen. But if he can control the senses, there's no chance of his being victimized by sly fox-like women. Chanakya Pandit has also advised that if one has a wife like a sly fox, in other words, that's manipulating one for sense enjoyment, and one is under the control of such a person, not Matajis, this is not referring to devotee women who are only concerned with spiritual life and service, but sly fox-like women with men who are weak and engaged only in sense gratification. Chanakya Pandit has advised that if one has a wife like a sly fox, he must immediately give up his life at home and go to the forest. Matayasya grihe nasti barja chapriya vadini aranyam tena gantavyam yataranyam tatagriham. Krishna conscious grihastas must be very careful of the sly fox woman. If the wife at home is obedient and follows her husband in Krishna consciousness, the home is welcome. Otherwise, one should give up one's home and go to the forest. Hit Fatma Patam Griyamanda Kupam Varam Gitoya Dharamashita. One should go to the forest and take shelter of the lotus feet of Hari, the Supreme Personality of Godhead. So Urvashi continued criticizing the conditioned nature of a woman. Women as a class, she said, are merciless and cunning. They cannot tolerate even a slight offense. For their own pleasure, they can do anything irreligious, and therefore they do not fear killing even a faithful husband or brother. Women are very easily seduced by men. And nowadays, the converse is also true. Therefore, polluted women give up the friendship of a man who is their well-wisher and establish false friendships amongst fools. Indeed, they seek newer and newer friends, one after another. O my dear king, you will be able to enjoy with me as my husband at the end of every year for one night only. In this way, you will have other children, one after another. Purport. Although Urvashi had adversely explained the nature of woman, Maharaj Pururava was very much attached to her, and therefore she wanted to give the king some concession by agreeing to be his wife for one night at the end of each year. Text 40. Understanding that Urvashi was pregnant, Pururava returned to his palace And at the end of the year, there at Kurukshetra, he again obtained the association of Urvashi, who was then the mother of a heroic son. Having regained Urvashi at the end of the year, King Pururava was most jubilant, and he enjoyed her company and sex for one night. But then he was very sorry at the thought of separation from her. So Urvashi spoke to him as follows. Urvashi said, "My dear king, seek shelter of the Gandharvas, for they will be able to deliver me to you again." In accordance with these words, we've heard so many pastimes of great personages who gave up the world, who gave up their material life to attain spiritual, the ultimate spiritual goal. But here, we're amazingly enough in the ninth canto of the Bhagavatam, hearing about Pururava, such a qualified king, the head practically of the moon dynasty, the third, the second son, the grandson of the moon. And he became so enamored by his material pleasure that all thoughts of spiritual life, he completely gave up. All thoughts of eternal happiness, he gave up for temporary sensual pleasures. So she told him, "If you take shelter of the Gandharvas, they will deliver me to you again." So in accordance with these words, he immediately did what she said, very obediently. The king satisfied the Gandharvas by prayers, and the Gandharvas, being pleased with him, gave him an Agnistani girl, I'm not sure exactly where she was from, who looked exactly like Urvashi, but they didn't give him Urvashi. And the thinking that the girl was Urvashi, the king began walking with her in the forest. But later he could understand that she was not Urvashi, but Agnistali. So he got a So as soon as he found out, he was so much enamored by not just any woman, even if she looked just like Urvashi, he loved her. So he left Agnistali in the forest and returned home, where he meditated all night upon God, personal Brahman, Lord Krishna, no, Urvashi. In the course of his meditation, because this was all came in the first of the yugas, Satyayuga, but while he was meditating, the Treta-yuga began. And the Treta-yuga, there is the process of sacrifice is recommended. Dwapara-yuga, deity worship, Treta-yuga, fire sacrifice. And therefore, as he was meditating, Treta-yuga began, and the system of sacrifices were revealed in his heart. Materialistic fruit of sacrifices. So he decided to perform a jagya, a sacrifice, to gain something material. And Prabhupada explains that in Kali Yuga, to please the Supreme, because the basis, when one performs these materialistic sacrifices, there is a process of pleasing God, of Hari. Always in all sacrifices, Om Vishnu is said, Om Hari. Because ultimately he is the one to be pleased, and he is called the Jagyapati. He is the Lord of sacrifice. So when he is pleased, through some demigod, he awards the result that the person wants. So the ultimate thing that one ultimately learns is to please Lord Hari, to please God, to please Vishnu. But what Hari means is he who takes away. So ultimately, when one attempts to please him, he'll take away one's material desires and leave one with a pure spiritual desires. So Prabhupada's purport, in the end of the purport to text 43, explains, to please the Supreme Personality of Godhead, yajna, sankirtana, prayer, the process in Kali Yuga, the only way possible is not by yajna, sacrifices, but by chanting Hare Krishna. Text 44-45. So when the process of fruit of jagyas became manifest in his heart, King Pururava went to the same spot where he had left the Agnistali girl And there he saw that from the womb of a Sami tree, an Aswata tree had grown. He took a piece of wood from that tree, which is very auspicious, and he made two aranis, two woods that he used to start a sacrificial fire. And if one knows the process and if one has spiritual potency, one can start a fire with this arani wood just by mantra. So he got this arani wood and he desired to go to the planet where Urvashi resided. He decided he didn't want to go anywhere else. He didn't want to duplicate, replicate Urvashi. He wanted her and her only. So he chanted mantras. He meditated upon the lower arani wood as Urvashi, the upper one as himself, and the piece of wood between them as his son. In this way, by his meditation, he ignited a fire. So instead of thinking of pleasing Krishna, he just thought of Urvashi. So from Pururava's rubbing of the aranis came a fire. By such a fire, one can achieve all success in material enjoyment and become purified in seminal birth, initiation, and in the performance of sacrifice, which are invoked with the combination letters of Om. Thus the fire was considered the son of Pururava. So he got the ability to gain something wonderful from this. And by means of that fire, Pururava, who desired to go to the planet where Urvashi resided, performed the sacrifice by which he satisfied the Supreme Personality of Godhead, Hari, the enjoyer of the results of sacrifices. Thus he worshipped the Lord, who is beyond the perception of the senses and is the reservoir of all demigods. So he worshipped the Lord to gain something material. In the Satyayuga, the first millennium, all the Vedic mantras were included in one mantra, pranava, the root of all Vedic mantras. That's Om. Pranava sarva vedeshu. Shabdake. What's that? Shabdake purusham vrishu. That I am the syllable Om. In the Vedic mantras, Krishna says. So Om means Radha and Krishna. But without pastimes. So the Supreme Personality of Godhead, this is in Satyayuga. In the Satyayuga, the first millennium, all the Vedic mantras were included in one mantra, pranava, Om, the root of all Vedic mantras. In other words, the Atava Veda alone was the source of all Vedic knowledge. The Supreme Personality of Godhead, Narayan, was the only worshipable deity, and there was no recommendation for worship of the demigods. Fire was only one, and the only order in life in human society was known as Hansa, or swans, or very exalted. And the final verse of the chapter. O Maharaj Prickett, at the beginning of Treta Yuga, King Pururava inaugurated a Karma Kanda sacrifice. Thus Pururava, who considered the Jagyic fire for his son, was able to go to the Gandhava Loka as he desired, and there he was with Urvashi. So, quite an interesting pastime. But it's not over here. There is a complete continuation of this. There is a part two. A spiritual part. Did you know that? Did you hear this story before? In the 11th canto, when Krishna speaks what is called the Aula Gita to Uddhava, and Krishna explains what happens next. And what happens next is Pururava goes to the planet of the Gandharvas and he's with Urvashi, but then gradually he becomes renounced, and he, in this Aila Gita, the song of Aila or Pururava, he, Krishna himself, chants to Uddhava the prayers that, or the realizations that Pururava had eventually, and he eventually leaves there and becomes fully renounced and spiritual. So it has a spiritually happy ending, this pastime does. Okay, we'll stop here. Any questions or comments?
What's the marriage of Guru
Pururava. What is the what? I'm sorry. What was?
His merits.
His merits? Well, he was... But it doesn't describe his spiritual merits. But he was an exalted person. He was an extremely exalted person. He was the grandson of the moon god. So, but he became completely enamored by the beauty of Urvashi. But it's true, it doesn't describe what his merits were, perhaps more in the 11th canto. More about that is described. But he actually became realized. So ultimately, if one is pious, ultimately one will become renounced. Even if one has material desires and one tries his best to satisfy those desires, because ultimately there is no satisfaction for the soul in those desires. So if one is impious, one will keep on trying again and again and again and again and again and again and again. And again and again and again. Oh, this time I didn't achieve my happiness because of this reason. I'll try again. Then I'll try again, I'll try again. But someone who comes in contact with spiritual truth and has some receptivity, or even if he has such strong material desires, he tries again and again, but he has a spiritual piety, eventually, by Krishna's grace, he realized that there is an incompatibility between happiness and being in a material body and being happy on the material level. Because the soul is spiritual. The soul is eternal. Its composition is different from matter. Just like the example that we use is the fish out of water. Whatever the fish pleasures, the fish has while he's out of water, he cannot be happy. So whatever pleasures we have without the water of our spiritual life, our eternal life, we cannot be happy. So that is a hard conclusion to reach. But disappointment is perhaps the great practical teacher. If one is extremely pious spiritually, extremely intelligent, he'll just immediately figure it out. But that means practically that he's learned it from previous lives. But otherwise, someone will attempt to find his happiness in the material world. But if he's heard properly, maybe he'll learn his lesson after one attempt or two attempts or five attempts. But eventually, the material world will never actually give us what we want. So eventually, by hearing the truth of the spiritual path, we'll learn our lesson. But let me just say one other thing, that suffering doesn't bring spiritual advancement in and of itself, but it takes some type of spiritual piety to learn, come to the proper conclusion from the difficulties of the material world.
Yes. I just suddenly occurred to me about this King Pururava. Yeah. Is it possible that he was probably a man of very great love.
A man of?
Oh, great love. Love. He loved this Urvashi.
Yes.
And Urvashi left him not because of his neglect.
Yes. Indra made up a scheme.
She was actually taken by the Gandhavas.
There was a scheme.
In both cases.
Yes.
The land was stolen by the Gandhavas probably mystic powers.
Because Indra wanted her back.
Yeah, and of the illumination. In fact, she lost Buddha Uvasi not because of her fault.
But material love is considered a fault.
Oh.
Because what is it that is worthy of love after all? Is it the soul or the body? Because when the soul leaves the body, and that's called death, and there's a dead body loving there, the one who is left behind in the relationship will cry. Why? Because the love was actually directed to the life within the body, the soul. So that when we love another body, love somebody, it's considered that the love is misplaced, because the soul is that which is worthy of love.
Is it possible also, Prabhu, in this case, actually love Uvasi as a soul?
No, because he learned his lesson later.
I mean, his great love for Uvasi.
No.
It's materially, not spiritually.
It's material. It's lust, basically. He loved because she was so beautiful. She satisfied his senses. She was a heavenly damsel. Love is when one cares only about the other person.
Is it possible to love spiritually another person?
Yes. But one has to be spiritually advanced to do that. It's selfless. True love is selfless. But we've heard from Prabhupada that the closest thing to true love in the material world is the love of a mother for the child, because it's selfless. The child doesn't get anything. It's just love and service for its own sake. So one of the messages of the Krishna consciousness movement, of the teachings of Bhagavad Gita, Srimad Bhagavatam of Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, is that love is misplaced when given to bodies or objects. It's meant to be placed in Krishna. So place our love in Krishna, that's the message.
Actually, there's no such thing as love.
It's business. That's certainly the tendency. Because, again, what is it that we're loving? Is the body worthy of love? If it is, then why do you cry when the body is there and the soul leaves? No one loves a dead body. Have you seen a dead body? Yes or no?
Yes.
Can you love it? The thing that is lovable is clearly gone. It's matter. When there's a dead body, have you seen a dead body? Have you? Your pet goldfish, maybe. You've seen a dead body?
Yeah.
Where? Yeah. That which is lovable is clearly not there. It's like a piece of wood. We remember and we feel the sentiment, but we know he's gone. He is gone. That which is lovable within the body is gone. Did you have that experience when you saw your grandfather's body? Huh? He wasn't there. You know, the people in the funeral home, they shave him and decorate him nicely, but he's gone. It's a very heavy realization. Srimad Bhagavatam ki jai, Srila Prabhupada ki jai. Tomorrow, if Krishna allows, these stories that we're going to hear now, they're quite wild. Next one is Parsaram, the Lord's warrior incarnation. And then Jayati. And then we're moving towards hearing directly about the birth of Lord Krishna. So all these are to prepare us for Krishna's birth. So they're very pointed, actually. If you want to go to the heavenly planets due to your love, that you can do. But you can't go to Goloka Vrindavan due to being enamored with the material body. The love has to be purified like gold, like pure gold in 100 flames again and again and again and again, to remove out all the material selfishness from the love, all the lust from the love. Then, when we love Krishna with that type of purified heart, and Narottama Das Thakur uses that example, the love of Krishna, or love in Goloka Vrindavan, is like gold purified in 100 flames. That means It's purified once, the impurities are taken out. Then it's purified again, and more impurities, and then go until it's completely pure and soft.
Unalloyed,
exactly. No impurity. Then, when no impurities, no jnana karma, no selfishness is left in the heart, then we can be qualified. We can go to the heavenly planets, to the Gandharva planets, with this kind of love. But if we want to go to Golok, to be with Krishna, the heart has to be purified of all gross and selfishness. Thank you. Hare Krishna.